Several months ago, after a few years of planning, we decided to get some chickens. Sarah is a cat person, and I'm a dog person, so we thought that chickens were the next logical animal. So we picked up 6 2-day-old chicks, fuzzballs, really, and brought them back to our house where they lived in our living room for several months, cheeping and scurrying between the heat lamp and their food and water. When they're about 6 weeks old, just starting to sprout feathers in the midst of all that fuzz, we began to take them outside in our backyard for some supervised playtime. They hunted bugs and pecked at just about everything. It was, I'm wary to admit, pretty darn cute. So it was that one Friday morning when the boys were at school and Sarah and I had a day off together, we decided to lay the groundwork for the future chicken coop, trenching the perimeter for 1 foot square concrete pavers to thwart raccoons, laying welded wire down on the ground so that predators couldn't approach from underneath. All the while, we let the chicks, now about 4 or 5 inches tall, roam in the ferns and bask in the sun to their heart's content. It was Buffy who sounded the alarm. All of a sudden, she started cheeping and squawking like we had never heard. We spun around to see what was going on. I mean, what could be happening? We were like 8 feet away. But it was plain as day when we turned. A large orange tabby cat was in the middle of our flock of chicks, whirling and pouncing as they scattered. After a half second of being stunned, we lurched towards the commotion. I went after the cat, who took one last swipe before bounding up and leaping up to the top of our side fence. Sarah ran to gather up the chicks. I continued after the cat. Desperately trying to see if it had anything in its mouth. As if to check if I really meant business, this cat paused up on top of the fence, watching. But once it saw me reach for a rock, it jumped down the other side and sprinted across my neighbor's yard. But with one last glance, checked to see if I was still in pursuit before it went off scrambling into the next yard. Meanwhile, Sarah was combing the underbrush for our chicks. 1, 2, 3, a fourth under the fern, more searching, 5, but still only 5. We had Chocolate, Hot Sauce, Buffy, Dottie, and Rocky. But no ketchup. Where was ketchup? The chicks went back in the box and then back in the house. We spent the next hour searching, peeling branch by branch, leaf by leaf. We looked around the shed. We looked under the shed even. And there was no sign of ketchup. The adrenaline of the chase gave way to dread. Ironically, in our drive to protect these chicks in their future home, we had left them unprotected, vulnerable. We had failed in our responsibility to watch over these chicks as a mother hen does brood over her young. We felt miserable. But this sense of abject failure was compounded when we realized that the boys would be home from school in a few short hours, which is when I felt completely inadequate. What would we say? How would we explain what had happened? You may have heard that quote attributed to Albert Einstein. If you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. What if it's not only understanding that gets in your way, but your fear? This was just a chicken. But I had to face, in that moment, that I was not ready to talk about death with our boys. Never mind our not being able to protect their chicken. How were we going to pierce their world and expose them to finitude itself? The last time we talked intentionally about death was when their great-grandmother Sadie died, and one of them asked us for weeks about when Sarah and I would die. It's hard to believe that something which we absolutely know to be inevitable, our own death, the death of those we love, that this is something we do our utmost to avoid. Friends, how is it that we have come to know this circle? The circle of all that is, the circle of endings and of beginnings. How have we come to know this circle to be broken? Was it the fall? Was it the necessary effect of our having free will? Is it simply the way of all organic beings? What is clear is that this brokenness leaves us fractured, in pain. And so we turn away, we avert our gaze. Because if this is it, if this is the end, then we cannot bring ourselves to face it. You see, it wasn't just the stench that Martha was afraid of in our gospel. Her brother Lazarus was dead. She had been grieving for 4 days. It was done. Did she need to go back? Are we any different? How many times when hearing of someone's unfortunate death have we said, well, thank God I don't smoke. Or thank God I don't go to that part of town. Or thank God I don't do whatever that person did. Without even realizing it, without even meaning to, we build structures inside ourselves and in the world around us to protect us from this unalterable truth that we are dust, and to dust we shall return. We do our best to remove death from our homes, from our neighborhoods, from our very consciousness. If it is compartmentalized, and it's not that compartment that I live in, then I don't have to come in contact with it. And as a result, we have such little space in our lives and in our very selves for this truth that when we are confronted by death, our response is one of anger, of despondency, and ultimately of fear. The question that we faced with our boys, this question that swirls around us at all times, whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, is this: how do we live aware and alive in the midst of death? This question has been on our hearts and minds this past week as winds and rains and floods tore across the Northeast. How are we to live? What are we to believe to be true? In whom do we put our trust? Friends, it is this. This is what we proclaim at the beginning and at the end. Last night, right here in this space, at Jackie Wagner's memorial. This morning, in this space, at the baptism of Kate, of Gabriella, of Emmett. It is that this circle, which to all appearances has been profoundly broken, that this circle, in fact, is whole. I know full well that there are many who say that this is nothing more than wishful thinking. Christopher Hitchens went to his grave declaring as much. And yet, we may not be able to make out every curve. Often the circle is shrouded, obscured, in shadow. But ultimately, as we walk this way, trod by generation upon generation before us, we put our trust in the one who has bridged the chasm between heaven and hell, between life and death. This does not mean, this will not mean that we are without sorrow or grief. Our gospel this morning makes it plain that Jesus suffered with his friends. He wept for loss. And yet, we still proclaim that the shroud of death that is cast over all people has been destroyed. That which has kept us bound, afraid to love for fear of loss. From these bindings we have been set free. Nothing in this life or in what is to come can separate us from the love of God. My friend Paul spent time this past week building an ofrenda in his home. For this is the time of year. This is that thin space, 3 days spent at the edge of mystery. All Hallows' Eve, All Saints, All Souls. For some reason, this year he had the time and the inclination, so he paid attention to it. The ofrenda, the offering, is very much like the one that we have here in our side chapel. It's just not as big. It's in his home, it's really quite intimate. It sits in his dining room, in the center of his house. And in his ofrenda are photos, elements of life from those that he and his husband have loved but see no longer. His grandparents, a couple of pictures when they were young in their salad days, and some when they were older, closer to the time when Paul knew them. A picture of his husband's mother, but this one when she was about 4, with a bow in her hair and a look of remarkable patience on her face. There are pictures of pets. There are newspaper articles of lives from long ago that are now yellowed with age. And in keeping with the tradition of the ofrenda, there are candles to light the way for the departed to visit. Favorite food awaits, fresh fruit, a bottle of tequila. There are skulls and skeletons, and at the back of the space, the painting of a friend who was taken by AIDS a few decades ago. Paul still isn't sure why he made his ofrenda. The best he can point to is that once the idea came to him, he didn't want to ignore it. For as Ernest Becker and others have taught us, it is the denial of death which makes us sick. So maybe for Paul, this was a way to look death in the eye. a practice along the lines of the medieval tradition known as memento mori, which the Reverend Dan Prechtel reminded us of a few Ash Wednesdays ago. Remember that you will die. Memento mori. And with these words, we will live. Because even if Paul isn't sure why he offered this space to God, to remember those who have gone before, there is no doubt what has come from it. Perhaps unexpectedly, this space dedicated to dead people has become a wonderful space of life in his house. What he felt in the creation of this space and in walking by it and in praying with it has been a sense of connection, a belief, a trust that, in his words, dead people aren't altogether absent from us. They're dead, Paul says, but they're not gone. All of us go down to the dust. Yet even at the grave, we make our song. Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia.